This is a CC Radio podcast.
Welcome everyone to the bonus review for November. It's Paul here. We're doing the top favorite films, you know what I mean, films of all time. And as you're well aware by now, if you've been listening to this series, Wayne, too hard for him. He couldn't be asked. I can't possibly order 100 films. He could maybe deign to do his top 10 favorite films of all time, which will be the last episode of the show when that day rolls around. So to get there, I'm working my way through my 100, and I've invited on good friends and other independent podcasters to join me in this journey. And today, he nominated this number for himself, 70 through 61, because it includes 69, I believe was the rationale. It's Sam Hurley from the Movie Reviews and 20 Q's podcast. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Hello again, listeners. That's the level of maturity I'm at.
I'm interested. We've had Julio on for The Contrarians, had G Banger from Two Peas on a podcast, and then Dan from the Netflix and Spill podcast did the last 10. So I'm interested to see whether our film sort of selections and favorite films are a little bit closer together than certainly Julio's, but maybe a bit more along the lines of G Banger, because I think my level of maturity is much the same as yours, mate.
I'm highly curious as well. I'm like, yet to hear a crossover, is that right? You guys haven't had much of a crossover at
all? Not during the 10. Like, obviously, there's been some mention that are way later in my list, and some people said, oh, that would be on my list if we went higher later on, but not in the same 10. So I wonder if we'll break that today. Now, maybe just give a quick shout out about your show for anyone who still hasn't listened. I mean, you've been on 3 or 4 times now, so I would hope that everyone's taken the journey with you to do 20 Qs. But just in case, what's it all about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a podcast called Movie Reviews and 20 Qs, in which we take a movie and ask 20 questions about it. Funny that. That's pretty much it. If you guys haven't listened to it by now, I don't think there's any other way I could sell you on it. It's
Do it.
We've been on.
We've been on. Wayne and I a couple of times. Oh, Wayne and I once or twice.
Twice.
Yeah, Basic Instinct and Total Recall, and then I've done a couple of other guests as well. It's always great fun. It's a great show and really different from the usual movie review stuff that you hear. But today, then, this is getting real personal, and I have to kick it off by acknowledging there's been a change to my list. So we do this every couple of months, and somewhere in between I realized, how have I not got that film on my top 100 favorite films of all time list? So everything shuffled down one, which means the film which is not going to be mentioned today that I would have spoken about in more detail that gets missed out is 300, directed by Zack Snyder. That was my 70, is now my 71st favorite film of all time.
Oh, right.
So we won't go into any more detail on that. And the film which dropped off, which is now my 101st favorite film of all time, is Air Force One. Get off my plane. Very apt, given events around the world at the moment. Okay, so without any further ado, let's hear from you, Sam. How hard was it to make this list?
Oh, fuck you. That's all I've got to say. Wayne's got the right idea. Fuck you, Paul. This is bullshit, man. Like, my top 50, I'm happy with. Or like 53, 54, somewhere around there. I was like, okay, these are films I absolutely love. And then after that comes the films that are like 4.5 stars, 4 stars that I'm like, oh, I like that film. I really like that film. And then so I put it up and then I'm like, but do I really like it compared to this one? Do I really like it? Honestly, I've had a mental fucking breakdown today. It's been the worst day of my fucking life.
Sorry, but thanks for going to all that effort, which we're going to hear the results of very shortly. As people will know by now, my list was made a long time ago and I've just added to it whenever something really tickles my fancy, and that's obviously what happened since we last recorded. But all right, without any further ado then, Wayne! I'm so sorry, Sam. I'm so, so sorry.
I know we're both foul-mouthed bald men, but seriously, come on.
But only one of you is fully into ass play.
Oh, that you know of.
That's true. We'll have a word to Stacey off mic later on. all right, you're 70, sir. What is it?
Yep, so my number 70 is the only Western that will make this list. It has a very special place in my heart. It was a movie I watched when I was quite a young fella and really liked it. I've only gone back and watched it twice since, but it is The Good, The Bad, The Ugly.
Aha, right. Well, you've only watched it twice since because there's only been that many minutes in the day or in the year ever since you first watched it.
That is correct. I will agree with that assessment. It is an incredibly long movie. It's not very easily digestible, but it has one hell of a story. Mm-hmm. As Clint Eastwood at the height of his powers. I think it's the best Sergio Leone movie. And yeah, it's just a great spaghetti western.
Can't knock it at all. That said, my joke aside, I do appreciate the film. I watched it for the first time only a couple of years ago, actually, certainly in the days of the podcast as I worked my way through the IMDb top 250. And it is super high on that list, which does shock me because as much as you don't like Westerns, I do. And there's some pretty good Westerns out there. To say this is that much better than all the others is kind of surprising to me.
It is phenomenal. Like I did realize that this would be quite controversial, given it is within the top 10, I believe, on the IMDb right. top 250. Yep. It's like right up there. Once Upon a Time in America is also up there. I'm not as big a fan of that in terms of Westerns.
Nor me.
But yeah, I mean, this for me is like the penultimate, really.
All right. Well, there you go. Very, very nice way to kick us off then today. Now, my number 70 has one thing in common with your number 70, that is gunplay. Except my number 70 runs a fair bit shorter, probably about an hour and a half shorter, and has a lot more guns and a lot more bullets fired. I'm talking about John Woo's Hard Boiled from 1992. Now, have you seen this one, Sam?
I have seen this film. It's been a long time since I've seen it, and I can't say it made a long-lasting impression on me, but I can see why you appreciate it.
Well, sometimes when you watch a film, it comes along at just the right point in time in your life, and I'd have been maybe 19 years old when I saw this one, maybe even a trifle younger at 18, and we had this video store called Planet Video, which did all these sort of hard-to-find foreign language films and cult films, and we went down there and we hired this one out, and you know, it's guy holding two guns on the cover, and little did we know that we're about to watch a formative moment in our lives. I would say there's a fair degree in the film that we've made, Reap, which is, you know, a bit of lore amongst our listeners. Hardboiled has a fair bit of influence on that film. Basically, a lot of the action tropes that we've seen in the, well, since the last 28 years have come from John Woo, between this film and this previous one, The Killer. Two guns, jumping in through the air, firing, hitting everything, explosions going off behind you, shotguns that fire what seemingly are rounds that have small explosions in them, all that kind of stuff. Just chaos through some incredible scenes. And this has one of the greatest action shots in history, this amazing one shot where the cameraman or camera person is running in and out the action that's going on and never cutting. And it's just poetry in motion. It's got all the John Woo cliches, the doves, the birds, the slow-mo, the epic soundtrack, the extreme violence, and that's why I love Hardboiled as much as I do.
I was about to say, there must be doves in this. There's doves in John Woo. John Woo's fucking number one animal, definitely.
You bet there is. All right, back to you for your 69, dudes.
Oh, and I tried, Paul. I tried real fucking hard. I wanted to squeeze something in here. I wanted to put in Wild Things. I wanted to put in Showgirls. I wanted to put in Basic Instinct. Basic Instinct might be on my list, but might even be higher than this. I really wanted to jam something in there. God, I wanted to jam something in there at 69. But instead, I haven't. Instead, I've gone with another classic. My film going, or like film nerdery, started for me at university when drinking was incredibly expensive, but we had a local video store. We could go get like 10 films out for $5.
Oh yeah.
And it was the tits. It was the absolute tits. And so I progressively made my way through every single videotape in that video store. And they had the classic section, and I never really dabbled in classics, but soon I discovered that I really loved Alfred Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. And while making this list, he came up a couple of times, and the very tempting to put a whole lot of him, very tempting to put a whole lot of Quentin Tarantino or Scorsese or Kira Kurosawa or yep. the entire MCU. But I backed away. I resolved. I kept it to my top three. And this one for me, coming in at 69, is Rear Window. There's uh-huh. something about Rear Window that I just absolutely love. The direction, the fact it's set in one tiny little location, it still garners all this like intense suspense out of you, just draws it all out. Jimmy Stewart's at the top of his game. There's just something about it that really touched me.
Yeah, I watched it not long ago as I worked again through the IMDb top 250, and I liked it just fine. I didn't love it though. Like, there's a couple of Hitchcock's films which I really, really love. I won't mention them in case they do come up later for one of our lists, but this one I kind of was put off a bit by the Jimmy Stewart character's treatment of his girlfriend.
Oh, Grace Kelly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit rough.
He's a bit of a prick, and she's obviously a gorgeous woman who goes on to be a princess and just give up the whole acting gig, because who needs to work when you look like her? He doesn't seem to appreciate her one lick, and she's trying so hard to support him. And yeah, look, maybe it's a product of the times, but it was a bit hard for me to watch in 2019 or 18, whenever it was that I did sit down and watch this one. But otherwise, yeah, I get it. You know, Hitchcock is a classic or a revered filmmaker for a reason. He rarely puts a foot wrong, and yeah, it's a good thriller.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, some of these movies really date themselves, but this one for me is just one that hasn't. And it just feels sort of new and fresh and engaging. And even though when you know the story, it's a film you can come back and rewatch and you're like, okay, that's quite enjoyable. And I suppose a lot of my personal attraction to films is seeing the level of filmmaking that goes into it. And mm-hmm. this for me was very much ahead of its time. And you're right, like, sure, Jimmy Stewart probably shouldn't be going out with Grace Kelly, but at the same time, that's like Adam Sandler or Kevin James with all their partners and all their subsequent films, you know? Like, it was ahead of its time. It was showing an average dude with an incredibly hot woman, so there we go.
And of course, you will have seen the superior remake of this film, Disturbia.
Oh. What's your next one, Paul? Pretend I didn't fucking hear that.
I am joking, of course.
Okay,
my 69 also couldn't be smart with this choice. In fact, I'm not sure you get further away from what would be appropriate for a film in the number 69 spot. It was an Academy Award nominee from a few years back and one which made very high, I think maybe 3 on my films of 2018, even though it was released just the other side of 2017's New Year's. It is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, directed by Martin McDonagh. Have you seen this one, Sam?
Oh, of course. Great fucking call. That was one of my favorite films of that year. It's brilliant. It's a great film.
Does it make your list, or are you just being nice to me?
No, I'm not being nice. It's actually sitting at 72, Ooh. So it got bumped a couple of times today. In fact, it got bumped down as far as 80, I think, and then it got brought all the way back to 72. So
okay.
Maybe that's an indictment of all the other ones that's in the 70s, but nah, it's a great film.
So it's close to our first ever crossover in list or on the day of recording, at least, if I can put it that way. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's amazing. Obviously, it's powered by an incredible performance from Frances McDormand, who won the Academy Award that year for her portrayal of a mother who is trying to find justice for her raped and murdered daughter and doesn't believe the local police force is doing their best efforts, despite the fact that Woody Harrelson, the sheriff in town, is doing his absolute best. And unfortunately, he's been undermined by his second-in-command, which is played by Sam Rockwell, who is a racist piece of shit. And that's the best way you can describe him. Now, some people didn't like the arc that his character went through, but it kind of worked for me. I think his, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of being a better person than he's been shown to be at that point in time doesn't absolve him of his previous sins. But for others, it felt like it was a bit of that, you know, white savior complex coming into play again. So that washed over me. I was enraptured by this film in terms of just how enthralled, maybe that's a better word, just from beginning to end. It blew me away. Great film. Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri in the 69 spot. Sam, what's up next for you?
Great call. Frances McDormand, man. She's often the best thing in a lot of things that she's in.
For sure.
The next one is going to be considered blasphemy.
Ooh.
I'm pretty sure that these three films are supposed to be my 1, 2, and 3, given where I'm from. I'm basically going with Return of the King, aka Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. I know New Zealand. I know I'm supposed to have this at like 1, 2, and 3 with the other two. I know. I get it. I fucking get it. But there's something about Return of the King that's like, yeah, it's good, but it's not great. You know, there's like some great scenes, and I've rewatched this recently as well. I watched it about 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
Because I love it. Like, it's a really good film and I love it, but it's just lacking just a little bit more. So, I mean, really, what can we say that hasn't been said about this film already? Like, it's just stunning visually. Acting performances are great from a whole bunch of people that aren't typically powerhouse actors.
Mm-hmm.
Twists and turns in the stories, even if you read the books, you're still engaged and amazed by where it's taken you. We get a conclusion. Some say we might get too many conclusions. I would agree. But we do get a conclusion to the story that's been gripping us for the previous 9 hours. So, I mean, what more can you want, really?
Yeah, not much. I agree. I think this is a great film. It's not on my list, but it would certainly be in my top 200 films of all time. I love this one. I actually prefer Fellowship. That's my favorite of the three. We've talked about it on the show.
Yep, we have.
I think this is the second best of them, and for some reason, I don't like Two Towers as much as the others. I'm due a rewatch of this. I haven't watched them again in probably 5 or 6 years, so I think I'm ready to go back to the well and sit down. Maybe when my daughter gets old enough to watch and appreciate them, that would be a good opportunity to do so. She's probably a year or two away at this point in time, though, so yeah, looking forward to that in future and understand the choice, especially given your heritage.
Yeah, I know. We have to say it. I mean, the other one, Fellowship, that we've talked about, yeah, I mean, it's my favorite of the three. That makes an appearance, obviously. Two Towers, I see where you're coming from. I rewatched Two Towers and Return of the King. I sort of did them back to back. Two Towers, to me, almost got to a point where I'm like, oh, just hurry up. Where's Helm's Deep?
Yes, that's it.
You know?
That was my reaction to too much tree beard or walking trees, moving really slowly and talking about things that don't really matter for mine.
Exactly. Yep. No, I completely agree.
And of course, then they go back to the well for the Hobbit films.
The what films?
Yeah, exactly.
As much as you refuse to acknowledge in Indiana Jones, there's a couple of films that we refuse to acknowledge in New Zealand.
Well, I don't understand what you're talking about. There's three magnificent Indiana Jones films. We've got a fourth one coming.
That's exactly how I feel about the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Gotcha.
There's three movies in that film universe and that's it.
All right. Well, my 68 then is going back classic, even more classic action than Hard Boiled was, back to 1989 and one of the few sequels that I think is superior to the original, though you'll probably get a lot of, I'll probably get a lot of blowback on that one when I say this. It's Richard Donner's Lethal Weapon 2 from 1989. I like this one more than the first one.
Ooh, that's a big call.
It's controversial. I get it.
It is.
I think this one is more of an action film. The first one was a bit more of a almost psychological thriller with some great action beats. Nothing wrong with it. Love it. I also think the ending of this one is far more satisfying than a pretty piss-weak fight between Riggs and Gary Busey on a lawn where a fire hydrant is spitting out water everywhere. I think the ending of this one, far more satisfying. And this one takes, I would say, almost more chances in the way that it just offs the love interest out of nowhere, which is a big call, which really resonated for me when I was a youngster. But for me, it's just even the introduction of Joe Pesci works in this film. Okay, don't get me started on Lethal Weapon 3. But in Lethal Weapon 2, you know, they fuck you at the drive-thru and that rant is just epic. Some of the action scenes are just awesome in this movie. And I love how unhinged Riggs becomes when his girlfriend is killed, as well as the bad guys being racist South Africans, which is, you know, never a bad thing if you're going to call out what was happening at the time in that way.
Diplomatic immunity
has just been revoked. Yeah. That film is so quotable. It's awesome. And originally, Shane Black was going to kill off Riggs at the end of this. He was meant to die when he got shot there. But then, of course, it made too much money, so they shot it a second way, and then they went with that option. Well, they could see it was going to make too much money, I should say. Okay, that's my 68. Back to you for your 67.
I'm just going to go straight into it. It's The Departed. It's a tour de force of Leonardo DiCaprio and Matt Dillon, as well as Jack Nicholson, as well as Mark Wahlberg, as well as bloody Alec Bourne. I mean, when do you say these types of things? When do you say, oh my God, Mark Wahlberg was really fucking good in that movie?
Yeah, and he was. Yeah, agreed.
And he was. He was one of the best things about that film. And Vera Farmiga as well, playing the token female, apparently. It's just, but still, it's just like, it's a really engaging film. I've watched the, you know, original material.
Infernal Affairs,
Infernal Affairs, watch that. You know, it's amazing that they took what is like a pretty good film and they turned it into this, which is, I think, way superior to that original film.
100%.
And it's just engaging and, you know, like, the only knocks against it is, sure, there's some overhanded symbolism throughout it. Like, when we see a character and then we see a shot of a rat and you're like, okay, yeah, we get it, he's a rat. Thank you, congrats. But at the same time, I mean, these are just tiny knocks against an otherwise engrossing film that from start to finish, I'm like, where the fuck is this going to go?
And it doesn't go the way you expect. I think that's the real power of this movie. It's not afraid to take some really bold leaps. And also when you think about it, like Martin Scorsese at this point in time in the mid-2000s, okay, he wins an Academy Award for this film, long overdue, I think we'd all agree. Mm. But he chooses to remake a film. Like, he can see, obviously, the potential for it, how it could be better, and it is, as you've just mentioned, but it kind of blows my mind that a director of the caliber of Scorsese was prepared to remake anybody's stuff, even at that point in time.
Yeah, it's a good point, really, because he's not that type of guy. He's very much a writer and director himself, dude.
Yeah, that's
a good point.
It's him from the get-go, and he has these passion projects and, you know, whatever the one he's trying to get off the ground now, which with a price tag of somewhere in the order of $250 million or whatever, and even Netflix balked at that. So it's lightning coming together in a bottle. It's one of the best sort of foreign language remakes of a foreign language film ever. Probably the best off the top of my head, I reckon.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, nice choice. My 67 is a film, again, I'm all about the classics in the sort of my, I don't know how to call this, when my love of films was coming out. And so now we're mid-90s, 1994. I have a love-hate relationship with this filmmaker, Luc Besson. I hate some of his shit. I cannot understand the love for The Fifth Element. It does nothing for me. And pretty much everything he's had post-2000 has been terrible. I feel like there's something that he's done that I didn't mind so much. But anyway, this is by far my favorite film of his. I'm talking Leon, The Professional, or just The Professional, if you prefer. Leon has one of those films which just struck a nerve for me and all my friends at the time. it's effectively a thriller first and foremost, with a couple of kick-ass action scenes, and it just follows this guy who, he's very simple. He's probably on the spectrum, I would guess, is how we would refer to it these days. And he's just good at killing people. And so he gets manipulated by sort of mob boss in town to off all his enemies and gets paid for that. And the boss even keeps all his money. So this is very frugal, very simple existence down the corridor from a family with a piece of shit father and a junky mother and Matilda, played Natalie Portman in her first role, when the family falls afoul of corrupt EA agent Gary Oldman, Norman Stansfield. She's the only survivor, and he takes her in and starts to show her how to clean, i.e. kill people. And it's the relationship between the two of them. The theatrical cut, brilliant. Can't fault it. Love it to pieces. The director's cut, I knock half a star off because...
Really?
Yeah, it gets way too creepy between the two of them. Like, I know she professes her love for him, but of course he just doesn't reciprocate it. He's like, no, we, you know, this is a parental thing. This is not a romantic thing. Even in his simple way, he's really putting the boundaries down. In the theatrical cut, in the director's cut, it's a little bit, I mean, nothing happens, don't get me wrong, but it's a little bit more uncomfortable, let me put it that way.
Ugh, no, you know, thanks. I'm not going
to
watch that.
So I don't really want to acknowledge that and just come back to the theatrical. It's an amazing film. Do check it out. With an absolutely astounding last 20 minutes, one of the best endings to a film I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's really good. It's in my top 100. I'm not going to lie. It doesn't make up this high.
It's high, a bit lower.
94 or 95.
Okay. I'll take that. Yep.
Yeah, mid-90s. Yeah, a highly enjoyable film. One that I need to rewatch. Gary Oldman's just fucking phenomenal in it.
Yeah, he is. And so is Jean Reno. Every time I see him now, I still just go, oh, hey, it's Leon. Like, he's in some Netflix film at the moment called Rogue City. I'm like, oh, look, Leon's in another film. Awesome, I'll check that out.
Yeah, Two to Five Bloods. That's the same thing. I was like, oh, look, it's Leon.
Yeah. Nice.
Moves me over to my 66. Now, this feels wrong to me. This feels very fucking wrong because this film, for a lot of my life, was my second or third favorite film. And now it's tumbled all the way down to 66. And
where did it touch you, Sam?
Oh, it touched me everywhere, but but I don't know what it is. Maybe it was the rewatch. And it's funny because you guys are doing an episode on top directorial debuts, and this is one of them. This is Reservoir Dogs by Quentin Tarantino.
So no!
I knew it would be for you. I almost, like, maybe subconsciously put this in here just to piss you off or something. But it's just... I don't know what's happened with it. It used to be my second or third favorite film. There's a Quentin Tarantino film that's incredibly fucking high on my list. So high, you know, probably needs to be fucking put in a hospital right now. But it's but something about Reservoir Dogs. I rewatched it 2 months ago, 3 months ago maybe. And I was like, yeah, I enjoyed this, but it's not as good as something else and another one. So yeah,
stop it. Yep. Just stop it.
It's just slipped.
I can't agree with that. I love this movie. Anytime. It's one of those films that's on TV. Not that I watch TV very often, but you're flipping through it. Oh, it's on Netflix. Maybe I'll stick it on. And then I watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm completely captivated. The story I've told on the show before is when this came out on home cinema, I'd seen it at the movies, home cinema, on video. I was in the video store because, as you can imagine, the movie geek that I am, I was very friendly with a couple of video store owners through my day. And, you know, 19-year-old, I think this is 94, is it? 93.
92.
Oh, 92, there you go. I must have only just turned 18 by the time it came out. Yeah. And obviously, it was always delayed by the time it came out in Australia back in those days. I was down at the video store, and she was saying, yeah, it's coming in this afternoon. Delivery guy comes in, brings like 30 copies of it. I'm the first guy who gets it out on video to watch and take home. And then I bought it as soon as I humanly could on VHS as well. That's how much I love this movie. Everything about it is just so fucking cool. I know that's a very lame way of describing it, and I'll talk about it in much more detail when eventually I talk about it, because it's a way higher than this. That's all I'll say.
It was, I've got to hand it to it. It was like one of those films that originally got me into like gritty films sort of type of thing. Like, we would have been 12 or 13 years old. Me and Spanky, sometimes occasionally co-host on my podcast, and his old man took us to the video store and said, you guys go pick a movie and I'll pick a movie and you guys can watch both of them. And I think I picked something like Star Trek Generations or something like that.
Right, right.
Like something just like really average. Might have been Event Horizon. I think it was Event Horizon. Yeah, we watched it and we were like, oh, this is okay, but this is fucking boring. And then we watched Reservoir Dogs And there was about five or six of us, and we're all like, Spanky's old man had already seen it. He was like, okay, you guys got to pick the colors of who you are. And so I want to be Mr. Blonde. And it was fucking like from then on, we all used to call each other that for like about a month. But I'm telling you now,
I thought you were going to say until the other, like till the current day, we still refer to each other that way off mic.
Oh, no, I wish. But yeah, it sort of wore off as things do when you're 12. But I also will say, don't show this to 12-year-olds. That's a fucking stupid idea.
Yep, I can see that for sure. Ah, nice. But look, all right, I'm happy it's on your list at the very least, because I'd be Devo if it didn't make it, given how much we seem to have similar tastes in film. I wonder if my 66, again, I'm very era-specific here. In fact, looking at my list, there's only a couple of films after 2000 that are in this 10. And my number 66 is just one that it holds such a special place in my heart. Again, saw it at the right time, struck a chord. I probably saw this when I was in high school, and that's what it's all about. It's about being in high school and being too cool for it, and then taking everyone for a ride through the process. It's John Hughes' Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Interesting. I hate this movie. I can't fucking stand that little dickhead. God, I sympathize with the teacher. I'm like, this little motherfucker has just ruined his best friend's life and doesn't give a fuck.
That is true. He does seem very cliche, or very blasé, I should say, about how he handles Cameron and his dad's car. That aside, this film blows my mind how much I love it. Matthew Broderick in the role of a lifetime, so much so that we'll still see him popping up in adverts referencing being Ferris Bueller to this day. I reckon it would be hilarious to see a Ferris Bueller's Day Off 2 now, where he's an adult who's, you know, maybe a bit more jaded with the world, but just as smart. Maybe he's taken on someone younger who's as good as he was type stuff. That'd be awesome. But the talk to the camera, the fourth wall breaking, it works in this movie for me. I'm obviously not going to change your mind here, Sam, so I'm not going to get a lot of love in return. But scene to scene, the way how fast this film moves, how funny I find it as well, all the way through to the twist and shout, big sing-along, it all works for me. I love it. Ferris Bueller's Day Off is my 66.
Curious.
Sorry. Sorry.
Hey, I get to piss you off in one and you get to piss me off in another. Yeah. So there we go. Call it even.
All right. You're 65.
My 65 used to be my third favorite film of all time. It's amazing how much your like mind and appreciation of film expands. This was my third favorite film when I was about 11 or 12 years old, and all I gave a shit about was the original Star Wars trilogy.
Okay.
It's the weaker of the three. It's Return of the Jedi. I'm sorry to say that, Duty. I know how much you fucking love Return of the Jedi, and it's your favorite Star Wars film. It's not mine, bro. It's not mine, and it's slipped all the way down to 65. Still an enjoyable film, and then the fucking Ewoks show up. Yep. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it the Ewoks that undoes it for you? Actually, I think rewatching that movie, even the opening scenes with Luke trying to rescue Han, don't work that well. What works What works really well is the Luke Emperor Darth Vader stuff. That stuff's phenomenal.
That stuff is phenomenal. That final battle scene and like even the indoor scene. I mean, sure, yeah, the Ewoks come to the rescue, but like it's just like to have three battles playing out at the same time and still be engaged in all of them and still want to know what's going to happen next. And being fearful for the characters as well as one of the like best cinematic deaths in history where he takes off his mask and says, "Now go, my son." There's a lot of really good stuff in here. I mean, like, there's been a million other podcasts in the universe that have talked about Star Wars ad infinitum, so I'm not going to bother saying too much more about it, but it's still a very highly enjoyable film for me.
Nice. All right. Totally get that one. My 65 is from 1994, again, from that particular era, and it's going to raise a few eyebrows, I will be honest. It's another Quentin Tarantino film, and this is as high as it goes for me. It's Pulp Fiction.
Low.
For me, I like Reservoir Dogs more than Pulp Fiction. I always will, always have. I think it's a great follow-up. And obviously, it influenced cinema and changed cinema. And we've had, intervening 26 years, we've had so many imitations and copies of it. But that non-linear storytelling, the bunch of disparate characters who come together and bounce off each other, the dialogue, the music cues, it all works. It's magnificent. It's really, really good. My fiance had never seen it until not that long ago, 6 or 9 months ago. I finally got her to watch it, and even she enjoyed it because she just thought, oh, it's too violent. I can't handle it. Yeah, there's some violence in there, but it's, apart from Marvin and his head, it's not that much in your face. So what do you love about it so much, Sam? Give us your spiel.
Yeah, as I said, there's a Quentin Tarantino film that's so high it should be in a hospital right now. That's this one. That's like very much up there. I'm not going to say if it's number two, but it could be.
Oh, damn!
It's for me, it is almost the height of filmmaking achievement in a lot of ways. Like, you're right, like the non-linear stories, the bringing bloody... bringing all these characters together in a way that they're so interwoven that they, you know, like lead into stories that you have rewarding payoffs. You know, John Travolta was fucking dead in terms of a career. They brought him back and made him awesome. They had Bruce Willis in there, Samuel L. Jackson. It's just so engaging. And I will admit that, like, the thing for me that I've got to mention in terms of like why this is, I have such personal attention to, I mean, like why I personally love this film so much is because it's just so quotable. Like, If somebody walked into the room and said, put a gun to my head and said, hey, you've got to give me the exact fucking like storyline, or, you know, like you've got to quote the script directly of a film, I'd roll the dice on this one. I think this one would be the only one that I think I could stand a chance at.
That's a big call at 154 minutes. Like that, 154 minutes, that's a big call. There's a lot of talk in Tarantino films.
There is a lot of talk, and I feel like if I had a little bit of visual cues, I could probably get through it. But, I mean, me and Stacey watched it. Stacey enjoyed it, but she hated, because she watched it with me and Spanky. It's Spanky's favourite film. She absolutely fucking hated how we quoted it the entire time. I could never convince her to watch it again. But then we went and watched it at a... they've got like a sort of retro throwback cinema screenings that they do here. We went and watched it in that. And Stacey was stoked because she was like, sweet, Sam's not going to talk throughout the entirety of this film. Fuck that. I was getting kicked out. I was still saying all the fucking lines. I love this film. It's so engaging.
Nice. All right. Well, there you go. That's my 65. With apologies to you, Sam, and to probably half the listening audience, if not more.
Yes. I'm very ashamed.
What's your 64?
My 64 is... Well, we talked about... I feel like this is going to incur some of your ire as well, because I know how much you like this film. We mentioned him. We mentioned how it's hard to separate the filmmaker from the film, especially in this case where there's two of them that turned out to be complete pieces of shit. It's The Usual Suspects.
Yeah, low. I knew it. Very low.
I knew it. I knew it. And, again, it's your favourite film, and I feel like maybe my personal thoughts and feelings towards two absolute scumbags is influencing.
Yeah, I can see that. I try not to, but yeah.
Yeah, you try not to, and like, there's no way that you can't ignore the fact that this is some amazing filmmaking. The five characters that play the criminals just fit and gel and mesh perfectly. The storyline is so engaging. By the end, when we get that final twist, that final reveal, I mean, if you haven't seen this film by now, you're probably never fucking going to, but when you get to that final twist and reveal, and it's just played out in front of you, you feel so fucking stupid, yet it's so rewarding. You're like, I should have seen this coming. I should have worked this out. I didn't, and yet I'm fucking glad I didn't.
Jaw-dropping is the only way to describe that twist. Like, as it plays out on screen in front of you, we went and saw this just on a lark, a friend and I. We sat down in the cinema, Richard, and we were expecting nothing. Like, oh, you know, it's a crime film. But yeah, it's kind of in this era of post Pulp Fiction, all that kind of thing. It'd be something like that. Wow. Like, I'm so glad I didn't read much about it. Back in those days, didn't read a lot about films before I went and saw them. We just kind of went and saw the only thing, or the best one that was coming out that week is what we tended to do. And this one fit the bill. And rarely have I been so staggered. Maybe this is in the top three or four twists for me ever. It's so well played. It's so clever. The filmmaking is so good. The script from Christopher McQuarrie is what really nails this film. I think Singer's direction is fine, but it's the script which is the real seller, and then the performances on top of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, top three twists easily for me. I'm going to sound so far at my own ass, but it's very hard for me not to see a twist coming, because you watch so many of these movies, you see so many tropes and so much foreshadowing that you start realizing what's going to happen ahead of time. But this is one of those films I generally got to the end and was just like, I did not see that coming at all.
Yep, right there with you. Mm. All right, Maya 64, again, mid-90s. This time it's from a gentleman from your neck of the woods, from Peter Jackson. I'm talking The Frighteners from 1996.
Wow. I mean, I love you right now, but wow.
You're not a Frighteners fan?
I've watched it once when I was young, and I've never had any sort of impulse or desire to go back and watch it, which I think is a bit of a shame, but yeah.
If I can encourage you to, give it another bash. Like, I think this is the perfect blend of horror and comedy. There's a lot of death in this film. There's some great moments. Mostly it's played, though, quite light and for laughs, despite the fact that it sort of follows effectively the spirit, which is killing people and sucking the life force out of them, and then how that all plays out. And like, there's a couple little twists in here, but it's just got that Peter Jackson sensibility, which he was developing through this point of his career, where it's almost fun and playful,
yeah,
as well as being, at times, potentially quite scary. And then on top of that, you know, Michael J. Fox playing a bit of a bumbling psychic, and he can see ghosts, and they're quite hilarious in their exchanges as well, and eventually culminating in this sort of battle to the death. And yeah, quite a special effects extravaganza for the time. Doesn't hold up that way now. You have to put that aside. Like, the effects are pretty dated 24 years later. But yeah, right then and there, fuck, man, this one made an impression. This is one Wayne and I watched on Laserdisc.
Can you believe?
Laserdisc. Blink and you missed it medium, which, yeah, I'm sure you actually know what it is. Just probably never saw one in your whole life.
No, I don't think I've ever physically held a Laserdisc in my entire life, nor watched.
You would know, they're bigger than records and weigh about 7 million kilos.
Wow, you're selling me on it. Sounds awesome.
Anyway, that's The Frighteners and why I love it so much. Fair enough. Sam's not a huge fan.
No. I mean, appreciate it. Probably wouldn't make my top 500 or anything, really. It's not a film that's within my, you know, like, radar very much, but yeah.
And if you're in New Zealand, you can vote for me. I mean, not doing that.
I know, I've put one of the Lord of the Rings down in the 60s and now I'm fucking shitting on The Frighteners. I'm totally getting unvoted or downvoted, whatever. Moves you over to my next film. Talking about twist endings, here's another one that I did not see coming at all. Like, as much as Usual Suspects was a twist ending, I'm now reminding myself why this one got slightly ahead of Usual Suspects. It's a Korean film from 2003. It's Old Boy.
Yep, gotcha.
Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal from start to finish. The story is engaging. You don't know where it's going. You don't know why this guy's been put in a room. You know, he spends, 18 years? Or, no, not that long. Yeah, about 18 years in a room. And he basically, 15 years, I think. Yeah, he spends 15 years in a room, spends his whole entire time training and trying to figure out a way to beat the shit out of whoever has done this to him when he gets out, or discover why this has happened. There's an amazing one-shot hallway fight scene that TV mm-hmm. shows like Daredevil and a whole bunch of other stuff have lifted from, because it's just absolutely out of this world, where he just basically takes on probably about 100 dudes, maybe 200, in a hallway and just completely beats the shit out of all of them without breaking a sweat. I mean, yeah. And then again, the twist ending, the stuff that you see at the end, you just don't expect it. You do not ever expect something like that. And when it's dropped on you, you start feeling really fucking dirty. Not as dirty as the character feels, but really fucking dirty.
No one could possibly feel that dirty.
No.
That's for sure. Yeah, it's a good film. It's not on my top 100, but I certainly appreciate it and like it a great deal. And, you know, the less said about Spike Jonze's remake, Lee's remake, the better.
Yeah, I did bite my tongue a little bit when we started talking about The Departed, because I did want to take a little bit of a shit on Spike Lee's remake. It's completely fucking terrible, but yeah.
Yeah, yep. That's everything that was good about The Departed is wrong in this particular case, but doesn't take away from the original. So yeah, nice choice there for your 63. My 63, I'm jumping forward now to 2013, and one of the best cinematic experiences I've ever had, and that was seeing Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity in the theater.
Ooh. Interesting. Very interesting.
Fan, not a fan, Sam?
We recently did an episode on Gravity. I was completely blown away the second time that I was the first time. It's just, in terms of spectacle, it is amazing. It's just totally up there.
And I think it was Emily who said that, yeah, it doesn't hold up as well on the little screen, which is I would tend to agree with. Like, I've only watched it the once since it came out, and as much as I enjoyed it the second time around for the tension of it all and watching the craftsmanship, you're not as drawn into it without that big, huge black screen in front of you where it feels like space is really enveloping you. And that's the real brilliance of this movie, is it does feel like you're right there with Sandra Bullock's character as she goes through the trials and tribulations that she does to try and survive when the shuttle that she's on is basically destroyed by I don't know if it's asteroids or is it debris, whatever it is, that's just flying around the Earth.
Yeah, exploding debris from a satellite that's blown up.
Yeah, so hell of a film. And as you guys talked about in your episode, The only moment that gives me pause is where supposedly a character who's died suddenly walks back in and I'm like, this is, what the hell? This is terrible. Oh, okay. It's not real. Fine. But it really took me out of the film for a couple of minutes there, which I don't think was the best choice that they could have made at that point in the script.
Yeah. We discussed it quite a bit. I mean, like, you can see where it comes from. Like, she's suffering from oxygen deprivation mm-hmm. and she's effectively trying to kill herself, and it's like her subconscious willing this person into existence, and maybe it was executed a little bit poorly. I still enjoyed it. It's one of those things that, like, I'm sure every single moviegoer or cinephile or film fan basically has had that same experience where you've watched something gone, that was really fucking awesome, and then you go on the internet, discover everybody hates it, and you're like, huh? Yeah, that was one of those moments for me where everyone was like, that Clooney part coming back, what the fuck was that? And I'm like, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good.
A little bit of that for me with Tenet, I have to say. I was like, people aren't liking this? Present company included. Yeah. So yeah, that's my 63, Gravity.
Excellent. My number 62 is a stunning neo-noir. We've talked about Kevin Spacey. It's LA Confidential. It's from 1997.
Oh, yeah. Great film.
We've mentioned this. It's like one of those films that if you're flicking through the channels and it comes on and you're like, oh, hey, I'll watch a little bit of this till I get bored, and then the credits roll and you're like, I better go to bed. You know, it's one of those films that like literally just sucks you in. You follow the story and it's just amazing. And it was kind of bizarre that it's such a Hollywood film. It stars two and very famous Australians in the lead role. I thought that was quite bizarre, quite interesting, but at the same time, yeah, I mean. Engaging characters, interwoven storylines, stunning direction. It just feels fresh and new and vibrant, even though it's like a period piece. There's something about it that just really resonates with me.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's not on my list, which is kind of surprising me. I would have thought, yeah, that'll make my top 100. Maybe it should have. As I look at what is my number 100, it's probably a better film than that. So there's a bit of an oversight. No, I think it's a wonderful movie. And if you've read, I don't know if you've read any of James Ellroy's novels, The LA Quartet.
No, I've been meaning to for a long time, but no, never got around to it.
Look, they're good. They're very hard to read. He writes a particular kind of staccato way, which is difficult to kind of get your head around, especially as you are a published author, and you probably go, whoa, we'll come back to that later. The job that they did to translate that book into this self-contained movie without having references to the other books is incredible. They've done an outstanding job, not just in the casting, but just in terms of making this story work in a 2-hour, 15-minute film or whatever it was. Mm. So, yeah, it's phenomenal. And it probably kickstarted Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe's career. Russell Crowe obviously took it a bit further than Guy Pearce did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
All right, over to my 62. And this one is going to make one listen to the show pretty angry that it's this low down. Sorry, Duty. My number 62 is Hot Fuzz, as directed by Edgar Wright.
Fair enough. That is my 71.
Oh, well, that's as close as we can get to having a crossover with not having a crossover.
Yep.
So close. This film's magnificent. It's hilarious. It's so many references. It's just Edgar Wright is, I've said it time and again on the show, he's, if not my favorite filmmaker, he's very, very close, pound for pound. Never made a bad film in my books. He's made an average one, but otherwise they're all fantastic. And I'm so keen to see Last Night in Soho when it finally gets released, hopefully next year. But this one is the ultimate pastiche, homage of buddy cop films with Simon Pegg, Nick Frost again, the slick city cop with the bumbling country cop, and they come together to work out who is murdering all these people in this sleepy British village. And where it goes is unpredictable and hilariously violent in places and just so, so much fun.
It's a great film, and like you're right, like it completely changes genre halfway through, which is like the best part. You go from this almost police procedural sort of crime thriller into just sheer balls to the wall Bad Boys level action. It's just fucking amazing. Like it's an awesome film. It for me, it revolves and rotates with another one of his films, maybe his debut film, or maybe not. No, it's not his debut film, it's from the dead. But those two revolve as to which is my favorite. And I mean, who knows, maybe tomorrow morning, Duty, I would wake up and say, Hot Fuzz is better than Shaun of the Dead. But yeah, they're very, very much awesome films.
They are. So hopefully Duty will forgive me and you. You had it even lower. So, Duty, all things being relative. that's my 62, Hot Fuzz.
Awesome. My 61, some may say that this is the 7th best war film of all time.
Oh, God.
One might say this is the 7th best war film of all time.
Is it your 7th best war film, Sam? Is it 6 higher on your list?
No. Surprisingly, no. There's only one that would be classed as a war film that's higher than this. In fact, it's
fair enough.
About 3 spots higher than this. But yeah, it's Saving Private Ryan. Of course it's Saving Private Ryan. That film...
No!
I knew it would be.
Which is the sound of a shell falling on top of you.
I knew it would be. I absolutely knew it would be. I was never that enamored by it the first time I watched it back in the 90s. And then as I've like gone back and rewatched it, it's just crept up, And it's just so stunning. Like, it's so amazing that you get sort of thrust into this conflict. You get, yeah, that opening scene, that first half an hour, the storming of the beach of Normandy. Everyone's gone on about how amazing it is, but it's just like executed perfectly. It's just phenomenal. And
absolutely.
Then you get thrust into the lives of these characters and you know tidbits about them, little tidbits about them, and like similar to a good horror film, when they eventually start dying, you actually legitimately feel sorry for them. You're like, oh, not that guy, I fucking liked him. And so it's executed so well. And like, Steven Spielberg only has maybe one or two other films higher on my list, and I mean, what more good things can I say about it, really?
Well described, and I totally agree. There's so many strengths to this film in particular. Yes, the opening scene and the end battle scene's also incredible. The end one is more because by that stage, you're so invested in the characters, as you implied. But of course, some of them don't make it that far. And in at least one case I can remember, it's really painful, really harrowing, that death. And then there's another one during the end battle scene, which ranks among my most difficult to watch scenes in movie history. So that's how affecting this film was. And I love it. I think it's technically, it's such an achievement as well. You stick this on as a 4K disc and watch it, just the sound envelops you. The vision, it leaps off the screen at you. It's been hailed by many veterans who were alive at the time this film was released, saying this is as close as you can get to what it was actually like. So hats off to Steven Spielberg, and well done, Sam, for having it on your list. I'm pleased that it's here and way higher than your seventh best war film of all time.
Way higher. I mean, it is. It's a great film. It deserves all the adulation. According to the Academy, it's not as good as Shakespeare in Love, but they said about that the fucking better, because that is just a complete load of fucking bullshit. Yeah,
that's one of the biggest travesties in Academy history, as was Pulp Fiction not winning for that year as well.
Mm, yep.
All right, well then, to wrap this one up then today, my 61 is Back to the 90s, and this is perhaps the best example of how to stretch a budget in my mind so far. And if were it not for the MPA interfering with the end scene, this would be even higher, I believe, on my list. And I'm talking about Robert Rodriguez's 1995 film Desperado.
Holy shit. Yes, that is a great choice. I knew there was going to be a film that would make me go, oh, you stupid fucking asshole, you've got to put that on. And that's it. God fucking damn it.
Desperado, like, it's unbelievable this film was made for $7 million. Like, it looks like a $45 million, maybe a $50 million film. It signals the arrival, for me at least, of Antonio Banderas and Salma Hayek. And dear God, was there a woman more alluring at this point in time than Salma Hayek? Maybe Sharon Stone, but Salma Hayek was just a stunning.
Yeah.
The bits, the way, I mean, there's Quentin Tarantino, there's Steve Buscemi, there's Cheech Marin in this film, and Danny Trejo, all of these people come together, and it's basically the story about a mariachi who arrives in town, and he's mistaken as a hitman, and so he starts to kill them as he goes. It's as simple as that. Rescues the beautiful woman, and then the two of them go to town to kill off this drug lord who is trying to kill them as well. It's astounding. If the end of the film, the lore goes, it was so violent, the final fight scene, that, and this is the only knock on the film and why it's down here at 61 and not higher, that Rodriguez just gave up. He said, screw it. And he just fades to white as El Mariachi blows away the drug lord. And that's it. And you're like, what? We're building to something just amazing. And instead, we got kind of a little bit of a letdown. So, yeah, so close to being one of the greatest action films of all time. Instead, it now languishes at my 61st place on this list.
Yeah, and I'm kind of let down that you didn't mention what is probably the best character in this film, which is the rocket launcher guitar case. He's the man.
I think that's Kampa, if I'm not mistaken, who plays in the original El Mariachi film, plays the mariachi. So, he gets to reappear here in a more minor role. So, yeah.
With a goddamn rocket launcher coming out of a guitar case. There is
guitar case.
Yeah.
Bullets that go around, that bend around corners when Antonio Banderas fires them. It's ridiculous. It's so over the top, but it just works. It's amazing.
Yep.
All right. That's it. Well, we don't do honorable mentions, obviously, because we just stopped there. Ready for the next 10.
I've got another 90 if you want to hear them. Yeah.
We will be compiling these into the ultimate list one day as we near the end of this list and revealing those as part of the show, and maybe getting all you contributors on together to talk through the 10 best between us all, which might be a lot of fun as well, although a hell of an edit. So yes. I'm not going to promise on that one. But all right, Sam, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, normally I would say, tell everyone where they can find your show. You can probably just give me that in one sentence. More importantly, let's hear about you having succeeded at a dream that I've long had in life ever since I was young. You are now a published author.
That is correct. That is correct. I have 50 copies of my book downstairs ready to sign and send to friends, as well as it being available on Amazon and Book Depository and Barnes & Noble and all those great book sites. I wrote a book called Compliance by Sam Hurley. If you search for it, you should be able to find it. Basic plot is that a terrorist attack happens in Boston and the world's sort of like, why did that happen? And then basically a mysterious stranger sort of travels the world and recruits 7 different people at 7 different stages in their life when they might be easily pliable or moldable, and basically says, you guys have to come with me and we are going to take down an evil organization. And if that sounds pretty stock standard, that's probably... That's the general premise to hook you in. What it actually is, who the main character really is, as well as what they're actually there and what's actually happening, that's the bit we'll make you keep around and finish till the end.
Sounds intriguing. I am so stoked that you've become published. Now, can I ask, did you publish this yourself? Have you got a deal in place with a publisher?
Yeah, no, it's all self-published at the moment. I tried a couple of New Zealand publishers and basically got told the same thing, which is if you're not a famous sporting star and it's during COVID, don't even bother trying. So
right.
Self-publishing at the moment, so it's still available out there for everyone to buy and get their hands on, but you won't see it in bookstores just yet unless it becomes incredibly popular. So if you want to help make it incredibly popular, by all means, I would love that.
Well, who wouldn't? So there you go. I'm going to be buying myself a copy. If that sounds like your jam, and if you've liked our list today, which are mostly that sort of action thriller bent, I guess you could say, then it sounds like this book will be for you. So I'm keen as, mate, and congratulations. It's a hell of an achievement.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's it for us today. You can find us at all the usual places. You know where to find us by now if you're listening to this bonus episode. And if you don't, then just search the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews. Same thing, just search Movie Reviews and 20Q, Sam.
Yeah, that's the one. If you search Movie Reviews in and then type the number 20, don't like write it out as in T-W-E-N-T-Y. Just write 20. You should be able to find us.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to join me today, Sam. Really appreciate it. And for the hard work in putting this list together, because, you know, it is like picking your favorite child, given that you and I at this point in time only have one child each.
Yeah.
That's not normally so hard, but when you've got 100 at least of them, makes it a lot more difficult. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I still hate you right now. I'm still going to go. I know I'm going to wake up at like 4 in the morning and go, oh, what about fucking that? Oh, fuck.
All right. Well, I hope you don't hate too hard during the listen back down the track. But again, appreciate this. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you all for listening. My name is Paul.
My name is Sam.
And this has been The Soundboard.
Get off my plane.
We'll catch you next time.
Cheers.